Welcome to the Reason Roundtable, your weekly pod and video cast brought to you by the Magazine of Free Minds and Free Markets. I am Matt Welch, joined by Nick Gillespie, Peter Suderman, and Catherine Mangue Ward. Hello, everyone.
Howdy.
Hey, Matt.
Happy Monday.
We are going to get to the unhappy and awful fires that are rampaging through Southern California here in a moment. But first, friends, one of the activities I love best is enjoying some adult beverages with friends and loved ones. And let me testify, there's no better way to cap off such a momentous evening than by feeling like a million bucks the next day. That is where pre-alcohol comes in. ZBiotics pre-alcohol probiotic drink is the world's first genetically engineered probiotic. It was invented by PhD scientists to tackle rough mornings after drinking. Here's how it works. When you drink, alcohol gets converted into a toxic byproduct in the gut. It is this byproduct and not dehydration that's to blame for your rough morning after, if you have one. Pre-alcohol produces an enzyme to break this byproduct down. Just remember to make ZBiotics your first drink of the night. And then drink responsibly, and then you'll feel your best tomorrow. So go to zbiotics.com/roundtable to learn more about this very helpful product. And get 15% off your first order when you use Roundtable at checkout. ZBiotics is backed with a 100% money-back guarantee. That's all the money. So if you're unsatisfied for any reason, they'll refund it. No questions asked. Remember, head over to zbiotics.com/roundtable and use the code roundtable at checkout for 15% off. Do it today. You'll be glad you did. All right. 1 week ago today, the National Weather Service, for only the fifth time in its history, issued a particularly dangerous situation, fire warning, red flag warning, that Southern California was in imminent danger of destructive fires due to hurricane force Santa Ana winds, low humidity, and abundant dry vegetation. The previous four such warnings preceded hugely damaging fires, and this one, as we have all watched in horror over the past week, has produced one of the worst fires in the history of the city and county of Los Angeles, where Reason, incidentally, has made its home since the late 1980s. As of Monday morning, the death toll has risen to 24. It's going to be more than that. The number of damaged or destroyed homes is north of 12,000. The burn footprint is 40,000 or so acres. The fire has touched 150,000 residents have been forced to evacuate. Scores of thousands remained without power. The two main fires, the Palisades Fire and the Eaton Fire, are still only a small amount of it are officially contained as of Monday morning. And perhaps most ominously of all, as of 4 a.m. Tuesday morning, California time, there's going to be another particularly dangerous situation warning from the National Weather Service until Wednesday noon. That looks really bad, and it might then affect places that so far have not been affected by the fire in the south and the east of Los Angeles. There has understandably been a lot of discussion, including at Reason, of course, sometimes quite pointed about the role of public policy up to and after the SoCal basin exploded, including the performance of elected officials, most notably Governor Gavin Newsom and Los Angeles Mayor Karen Bass, who by now infamously was in Ghana until Wednesday afternoon. Catherine, Reason has been writing about and making videos about California fire-related policies for basically ever. What is one bit of policy that you're looking at that we have written about long before this started and that we're reflecting on today that might have had some impact had it been planned better on this fire?
So this is a classic example of one of those, it's a natural disaster, and look, this natural disaster proves all of my public policy priors, right? And that is rampant. So I do want to say we're probably about to engage in some of that right now, but should all be, I guess, put an asterisk on it or kind of keep that in perspective. In California, a lot of what Reason has written about comes down to just the word prices in the end, right? We have a situation where you need desperately need more information What do people need? What do people want? Where are the risks? Where are potential ways to hedge those risks? And in general, public policy in California and increasingly in the whole United States is geared around sort of muting the information that prices can give us. So we can talk about this with respect to insurance and all kinds of other things. I'll talk about it about water, because there's been this huge back and forth on social media about whose fault is it that the water wasn't in the right place, right? And Trump has blamed sort of decisions not to allow water in the Central Valley Project and some other things, maybe for environmental reasons. Reason has been covering that for a long time. There is no doubt that all of those decisions are being made in a bonkers and bad way. It doesn't seem like he's actually right that that water could have or would have ended up in Los Angeles directly. On the other hand, all of the areas around Los Angeles don't have reasonable sharing agreements about their water. They all have these highly politicized, ridiculous agreements in which water cannot be had for any price. And I think that's the thing that I want to get back to. People are mad about private firefighting. They're mad about individuals that have taken extra measures to secure water for themselves. They're mad that the three kind of reservoirs that were supposed to protect the area were used up so quickly. But all of those things could be mitigated or improved if but water at very, very high prices could be brought in when it is needed. There's plenty of money in California and plenty of money in those neighborhoods that are affected even. And the fact that water can't get there is at least in part just because markets have not been allowed to function.
I think a lot of people wanted to fact check the most kind of pointed and sometimes outlandish sounding critiques from Donald Trump or Elon Musk or whoever. And so I think Donald Trump is referring to the Delta Smelt, which is a very famous, we can't do this thing in the Central Valley with water because we have to protect this fish. It's a historic kind of case that's been in the thorn in people's side for a really, really long time. It is also true that Proposition 1 passed 10 years ago, earmarking $2.7 billion for eight huge water storage projects, of which zilcho have been built. Peter, why don't you pick up the baton with
what? They're spending a lot of money in California, and then they have nothing to show for it?
What? That can't be right.
No.
That's crazy.
That's not just, by the way, the only water bond issue. There's been six, I think, or seven passed in the 21st century that between them, statewide propositions between them, have earmarked $34 billion worth of.
Maybe they could carry the water around on trains.
Oh, what if they had
like
high speed trains in California? That would be a great idea.
Peter, why don't you keep the conversation going about prices as a signal, as it may relate to something that people are going to be talking about nonstop for the next week, day, hour, or year?
The story with home insurance, with homeowners insurance in California, is a story of the perils of price control. So I recently wrote a feature for the print edition of Reason Magazine titled Everyone Hates Prices, the thesis of which is that prices provide us information, like Catherine was saying. And sometimes that information is that you can't have everything that you want in the world, or at least not for the price that you think you kind of sort of feel is right in your heart. And this is what has been happening with California's homeowners insurance situation, where state regulators have basically prohibited insurers from charging premiums that are enough to cover the costs. They have imposed all sorts of price caps, including up until this year, insurers were not allowed to price based on models that were used to predict the catastrophes. Now, that's a pretty weird thing coming from liberal politicians who are obsessed with climate change. For two reasons. One is that the way we sort of the reasons people are worried about climate change is because models say that climate change is going to happen and it's going to get worse. And two is the reason that people are terrified of climate change is that the worry is that climate change will make weather catastrophes much worse than they have been in the past. And so if you believe that weather catastrophes are going to get worse, then making it so that insurance companies can only charge based on past damage, you're inherently going to underprice the market. They did eventually change that, but only very recently. And so that has just caused huge problems in the homeowners insurance market in California, where a bunch of insurers have pulled out of the market, stopped issuing policies, stopped renewing policies. In the Palisades, it's something like Allstate is like basically pulled out or at least like 70% of the plan, something like that. They have, declined to renew. It's, and so you have this situation where insurers are paying out $1.09 on average in claims and other stuff for every dollar they take in. That doesn't work. The math doesn't, right? Like the math doesn't math when you don't put enough money into the system. And the reason they're not putting enough money in the system is because they are not allowed to charge enough. And now California has an answer to that, and that is FAIR, which is an acronym for something. It doesn't even matter what. It is a
fair access to insurance requirements.
There you go. Fair access to insurance requirements. It's a sort of state-backed insurance plan. And guess what? They've also prohibited that plan from raising rates. And it is incredibly undercapitalized, has something like less than $1 billion in cash reserves. And in the Palisades alone, there's billions and billions worth of exposure. We don't know the total damage yet. But the person who runs FAIR has given testimony saying basically one big incident and we're hosed. We just don't have the money to pay for it. Well, this seems like a big incident and it is going to be a real problem for California.
FAIR is financed by taking money from the existing homeowners insurance companies that are doing business in California. So not only can California insurance companies make less money, but their money is seized by the state to fund this lender of last resort thing. Quick follow-up, Peter, or anyone. California elected fire insurance, or not fire, just insurance commissioner, Ricardo Lara, a journalism school graduate, has issued
so really
a,
just like a high-status person in your
than
mind.
Education schools, right, at this point.
But sometimes in the same building or campus, has issued a 1 year, I think, moratorium on non-renewals or cancellations from insurance companies. So that will that help the problem?
Yeah, probably not in the long run. Like, again, the one thing about these fires is, yes, these fires are historically bad. At the same time, fires happen in California. They've been happening for a very long time. They're going to keep happening. You need an insurance market that is going to be equipped to pay for the damage that these fires cause. And all of these moves to restrict what insurers can do and what they can charge, all of these moves are going to make insurers either more likely to pull out of the market entirely or not able to price properly in a way that allows them to pay off the damages that happen.
And all of that in the end is just in the service of giving builders and individuals information about where they can afford to live, where it is safe to live. I mean, that's it. This is like, I think you can get lost when people say like, oh, the insurance companies will go under. Like, yes, that would be bad. But on the other hand, everyone hates insurance companies, so fuck them. But the real information that we need is like all these houses that burn down, should they be rebuilt and in what form and by whom and with what infrastructure under them? And those questions you can't answer if you don't have prices.
And I think part of this is that people just misunderstand what insurance is for. People think of insurance as, oh, it should just be a product that you pay a little bit of money for, and then there is an unlimited tap if anything happens. And again, the math just doesn't work if you think about it this way. We see this in health insurance all the time where people, sort of during the Obamacare debates, there was just this kind of hard to divine like where it came from, but the sense that health insurance should cost about as much as your cell phone plan, right? It should be about $100 a month, give or take, and it should cover absolutely everything. We see this with flood insurance. We see this with all sorts of just insurance all throughout the United States. People have this sense that it shouldn't be that expensive. And then when anything happens, it should pay out to in a kind of unlimited way. And that just doesn't actually work. And it doesn't allow people to make good decisions about their health, for example, or about where to site their expensive houses that they would like to have insurance on.
Last ad before we go to Nick on the FAIR insurance system, of which there exist in about 30 states, I believe. That's a creation, or the ability to do that is a creation of the 1968 Housing and Urban Development Act. And it was passed so that there would be a lender of last resorts, not necessarily for people to build houses in Malibu, but for people to live in poor riot-scarred areas, including along 14th Street and U Street in Washington, D.C., after the Martin Luther King post-assassination riots. Yep. Nick, you take up a baton now of public policy that you're thinking about relating to California, relating to these fires.
Yeah, and just to cap something, Ron Bailey of Reason staff in 2023 wrote about insurers leaving California because of the latest iterations and additions to FAIR and whatnot. So this, you know, this is not a surprise, or rather the outcomes are not going to be a surprise to anybody who's been following this. You just can't create higher and higher risks while letting people, you know, letting the insurers get less premium for that risk without having it all go bad. And, you know, to kind of pick up on something Peter, I think, was saying implicitly is that, you know, this is maybe the wrong time to say it, but it's these laws capping insurance premiums and guaranteeing more coverage for less money. Those don't, you know, the special interests that gets those pushed through are generally most people in any given jurisdiction because it seems like a good deal. And this is also an outgrowth of the fetishization of home ownership as opposed to renting. So, you know, this is a specifically California policy, which at least since the 70s has had a lot of screwed up policies about home ownership and things like that. But, you know, it's something that's representative throughout the country, really. What I was going to focus on when I moved to Los Angeles in 1993, in October of 93, to start working at Reason. And before the end of that first month that I worked there, there were then historic wildfires in and around LA that rained down ash. I mean, it was a time where you were squeegeeing, you know, a quarter inch of ash off of your windshield from West LA if you parked outside for a number of days. Then came rains, which wiped out, you know, whole massive parts of Malibu and other parts of Los Angeles, because there had been a drought for about 6 or 7 years before all of that. And then all of the vegetation was gone. And then in January of 1994, there was the Northridge earthquake. So it was not the best time to perhaps to move to Southern California.
But at least race relations were super good back then.
Yeah, you know what? Yeah. They were on the upswing, as was the housing market and things like that. So, yeah, you know, and this is something we can talk more about. I mean, L.A. is the most apocalyptic prone city in America, if not the world. And, you know, that's worth thinking about just as a big backdrop. But what I'm getting at is one of the first stories I wrote for Reason, actually, was about the way that Santa Monica, which really got ripped in the Northridge earthquake. It turned out there was a fault line nobody understood that actually went through Santa Monica, and it destroyed 100 buildings completely. They were red tagged, meaning that they could not be re-inhabited. They had to be taken down. 250 buildings or so in this town, which is not very big, were really severely damaged. And Santa Monica at the time had actual rent control, which has since been banned by the state, but and very, very stringent, strident zoning laws and things like that, so that if a homeowner or if a building owner took a building private or wanted to redo it, they not only had to build it with fewer housing units in it, but they had to give 25% of those units to like fair market or low market rates. So it was, you know, unbelievably strangled. It was impossible to either maintain buildings or you know, make them better in Santa Monica at that time. And in the wake of the Santa Monica, or rather the Northridge earthquake, they actually changed the laws to allow much more building to happen and pass through what was called pass through, where landlords or building owners could actually pass through the cost of improvements on amortized schedules, depending on the type of improvement, to tenants and things like that. And that is a model going forward here. It's somewhat good to see. Gavin Newsom yesterday said that he is, you know, suspending a bunch of hocus pocus bullshit so that people in Southern California don't get wrapped up. And the actual word he used or phrase was bureaucratic red tape in rebuilding efforts. And it's kind of like, why aren't you doing that to begin with? But this is one of the ways forward, which is allowing California to have something of a reset where it goes back to the build mentality that actually took it from being, you know, kind of a peripheral state in America to being, you know, the most populous state in the country after World War II. So that's, you know, kind of what I'm focused on. If there will be a serious discussion in the uniparty state, Matt, you've written about this a lot, and it always deserves to be underscored. California is the model of single party, absolute unified control of everything. And it has been a disaster. Gavin Newsom is kind of like the American Justin Trudeau. We are, you know, we're a decade plus out where we seem to have capped the worst excesses of a lot of bad top-down governance, you know, for the past dozen years or so. Will California learn from it? They have models of how to do this. And they even apparently have a governor who is really kind of an idiot, you know, saying the right things for the most part.
Doesn't that remind you just a little bit of when Joe Biden, after like weeks or maybe even months of refusing, narrowly suspended part of the Jones Act in order to get stuff to Puerto Rico when they needed stuff? And they were like, you know, just for like this one month, we're going to do this. We wouldn't, well, you know, like, and they were like, it'll make things easier to get places, right? Like to get stuff to a place that really needs them in a time of emergency. And like, yes. If you suspend the Jones Act, that's what happens. It makes it easier to do stuff.
What makes this, you know, likely or, you know, possible to happen is, despite the uniparty control, virtually every county, if not every county in California, moved towards the Republican Party in the last election. And people are fed up. I mean, Newsom, I was living in California during the pandemic at the end of 2020, when California, for the first time in since joining the union, lost population year over year. They lost a congressional seat because of the census. And Gavin Newsom actually said, this is, you know, this is a blip. This is not a trend. We don't have to worry. California is still the place, you know, where the dreamers of the American dream go. I mean, he's like a mentally deranged Joan Didion character at this point. But that was 4 or 5 years ago.
But you repeat yourself.
You know, maybe he has finally started to get the message, and that will have a cascade effect through the equally bad California state legislature and the municipal government of Los Angeles, which is, you know, Matt, it makes being in New York feel almost good when you only have idiots like Eric Adams, who, you know, calls press conferences when he's getting his eyebrows tweezed. But at least he's in the city. You know,
since when are you kink shaming, Nicholas?
Biden did come speak on the wildfires and talked about how he's worried because his son Hunter is out there, but he did become a great grandfather or something like that.
I assume we're going to discover that Hunter caused these fires, right? Like that's how this whole plot wraps up. Is like it was a spark.
Don't be sparking things up on your outdoor water slide.
If there's one person who sparks things up, we know.
How you end up with Karen Bass as mayor, first of all, is a chilling kind of idea. But how you end up with her as a plausible vice presidential candidate is a real damning thing to say about the state of the modern Democratic Party, I think. And it, per Nick's point, or the Nick Suderman dialectic about the Jones Act versus maybe a wake-up call for Gavin Newsom, I'm on the Jones Act interpretation of this for one big reason, which is that I think in 2008, 15 years ago or so, the LA Times wanted me to write about homelessness. You know, there's a spark of surges of homelessness all up and down the West Coast of the United States at the time. And people were, declaring emergency sessions. Oh, by the way, fun fact, there is an emergency session right now happening in the California legislature as called by Gavin Newsom. And it is to combat Donald Trump. That's the seriousness of his governance. But the thing that I was writing about, I looked at California had a what they call a Little Hoover Commission, which is their kind of blue ribbon commission. It's actually very good, where they get some of the better people at universities and commercial culture and whatever to butt heads together and come up with a gigantic, very good kind of white paper analyses of various things. And they came up with they were just actually looking at homelessness. And they produced these incredibly damning maps and charts of numbers, types of things that I can relate to. And what they said basically is that all of your like, oh, we're going to build affordable housing things, they're like a single drop of saliva in an ocean. Stop it. The thing in California is that anywhere that's 30 miles within the coast is like five times more expensive and five times more long to get anything built than things that are 100 miles in the coast. That is the problem. Stop doing that thing. So you could have paid attention to that at the time, which is 15 years ago. The thing wasn't even noticed by newspapers. Like no one cared that this very, very fact-rich 100 plus page report saying basically you're going to have homelessness and high housing costs if you don't fix this, you know, if you don't notice that red tape 15 years in advance, let alone the various knock-on effects that that's going to have in the disaster preparedness that you must have if you are governing California or any parts of Southern California in particular, but the whole damn state. It's liable to that. Catherine, why don't you close us out of this section by cogitating on whether this is an appropriate time to pile on the blue state governance model. There's a certain amount of glee of people in the wake of this deadly and awful disaster of saying, see, that's what you get for going Democratic. Is that a legitimate way to respond to this moment?
I don't really like to do tone policing, not least because my tone is nearly always wrong. So I assume I will be on the receiving end of it.
Defund the tone police?
Abolish the tone police. I mean, like I said at the very beginning, like the temptation to do this horrible disaster proves I was right all along is very strong. It happens after mass shootings. It happens after natural disasters. It happens and will happen after the U.S. economy collapses, as it eventually shall. And, you know, better to just say, what can we do better next time, I suppose. And in this case, it sure does seem like one of the things we could do better next time is not reelect Gavin Newsom. But I don't know that that's that might be too much to hope for.
All right. We're going to get to our listener question of the week here in a moment. But first, friends, are you a student between the ages of 16 and 24 looking for a transformative opportunity to support the foundations of a free society? Then Reliance College would like to extend you an invitation to the 2025 Great Connections Seminar in the wonderful city of Chicago from July 26th to August 2nd. My birthday will be during that time, so you can celebrate that as well. And Milton Friedman's. This year's theme, Reason and Free Will, dives into timeless ideas from writers such as Thomas Jefferson, Ayn Rand, and Aristotle. Students will sharpen their critical thinking in small dynamic groups, developing the intellectual tools needed to thrive in a free society. And then outside the classroom, they'll tour the city of Big Shoulders' museums and improv comedy and quirky regional food and drink, all while building lifelong connections. Parents, this program equips your kids to think, reason, and act independently. So go to reliancecollege.org/reason to learn more and apply. Early registration is just $400 before March 1st, including room and board with scholarships available. That's crazy. Don't miss out. Visit www.reliancecollege.org/reason to start your journey of critical thinking. Do it today. You'll be glad you did. All right. Reminder to email your brief queries to roundtable@reason.com. This one comes from beloved listener Steve Golson, who writes, "Hi, Roundtable. Is Trump the most libertarian president ever? Please discuss." And Steve helpfully included a URL of or Earl or whatever Karen Bass pronounces it as at Unheard, a piece by Sam Kahn in Unheard, basically making that very argument. Nick, you're the one who wears the MAGA shirt on this podcast. Is Trump the most libertarian president ever?
I want to point out it is a hair shirt. So
yes, it was implied.
No, I don't think that Trump was the worst president of my lifetime, but I also either will answer this by saying I don't think he's the most libertarian, or that it's very helpful to think about things in whether or not a given person is the most or least libertarian. The things that Trump did wrong that were very bad and very unlibertarian, including massive increases in spending and debt. He added almost depending on how you factor it, around $8 trillion in debt, Most of that, a majority of that, came before the COVID spending, which he not only signed off on, but really pushed, and is like notable for the massive amounts of waste and fraud and abuse that are we'll be picking through for the rest of our lives. He was terrible on lockdowns. He is the guy who pushed the national lockdown. We should remember that. His trade policy was bad. His tariffs were bad and costly. Awful on immigration. He dropped a historic number of bombs on Afghanistan and cranked up drone strikes on Yemen. So does that make him the most libertarian president ever? You know, good things happened on his watch. I like the fact that he was very pro-school choice, that he was in favor of right to try legislation and things like that. Generally speaking, the few actual entrepreneurs I know, small-time entrepreneurs, all said that under his administration, there was a market change when you were dealing with organizations like the FDA or other kinds of regulatory agencies for the most part. I take that all seriously. But, you know, if he's the most libertarian president that we've ever had, God, what a country.
Catherine?
Yeah, he's not the most libertarian president. I do think in his second term, like everything Nick said is right. I would also just double down on, you know, in this link, there's the quote is opposing chaos at the border isn't incompatible with a libertarian stance. That's true. That's accurate. Libertarians would also like to see an orderly border. But opposing immigration in its many legal forms and wanting to restrict it, throttling it generally, and fomenting populist opinion against immigrants is anti-libertarian, in my view. I think if there is a libertarian hope for his second term, it is this interesting phenomenon in which he seems to be kind of drawing out the latent libertarianism of some powerful, rich people. This is the Elon Musk of it all. This is the Mark Zuckerberg of it all. He's making them behave differently. And the question of like, what is that about and will it play out in his second administration seems interesting to me. But no, Donald Trump, I do not think, he is either pre or post ideological. I'm not sure which. And even when you just assemble the fact pattern, I don't think that the word libertarian is appropriate to describe it.
Catherine, how much of that different behavior from tech moguls do you attribute to Donald Trump? And how much do you attribute more like a backlash?
Just like the pendulum swing?
Yeah, a backlash to leftist overreach and a sense that you know, the deal that a lot of these folks who thought of themselves as Democrats, as liberals, as even people on the left to some degree or another for at least a period of time, they felt like, you know, they were going to support the Democrats. They were going to give to Democratic party institutions or left-leaning causes, and then they were going to be left alone to do their business. And what they found out was they were definitely not going to be left alone to do their business.
Yeah, I think that there is a broader pendulum swing sort of against, you know, wokeness, if you want to call it that, against kind of this theory of like, if I kind of comply and give money and keep my head down, the lefties will leave me alone. But I, you know, if Harris had won, it is hard for me to imagine that Musk and Zuckerberg and many others would be taking the path they're taking now, which is to be, you know, much more kind of vocal and explicit in opposition to antitrust, especially EU antitrust, to be pivoting their speech policies and a bunch of other things. Like, I think Trump's presence in the ecosystem is encouraging that. Will he ultimately poison it is the question, right? Like, if all these people are trying to curry favor with Trump in the places that their desires and libertarianism and Trump overlap, which part of the Venn diagram will give first? I bet it's going to be the libertarianism.
If Harris had won, Zuck would not be wearing the gold chain.
100% of my analysis on this question is gold chain based, and if you want to talk about it, we can. But I sense that perhaps you do not, Matt.
Peter, how do you answer the question? And we will get to the gold chain.
So I think the weakness of the piece that the listener sends to us, which is by Sam Kahn in Unheard, is that it's mostly about Trump's rhetorical stances in the past few months and currently, and sort of the people in his orbit, right? So the key bit says, In tandem with his tax eliminating, government downsizing rhetoric, Trump developed a partnership with a number of Wall Street, Silicon Valley barons, culminating in Musk throwing in his massive financial weight behind the GOP ticket. Two things: libertarian rhetoric and the new alliances in tech and finance went hand in hand, resulting in policy moves that should have utterly confounded Trump's populist fans during the campaign. Trump isn't president yet. All of that stuff hasn't happened. DOGE is going to be an advisory committee that is not even actually part of the government. So it may well do a bunch of good things. I may be applauding DOGE months from now, but it hasn't happened yet. And all of this is speculative. If you go back to Trump's actual record as president for the 4 years that he was in the office, he wasn't very libertarian. In particular during 2020, his final year, when we had COVID, when we had lockdowns, when we had massive amounts of government spending on emergency measures.
I would answer the question by just pointing out that tariffs are not libertarian. And also, just because you say you want to eliminate all the taxes, it's not a thing that a president can do with a stroke of a pen. He has this notion that somehow we're going to replace taxes, which we're not going to replace, with tariffs, which he can enact. The net balance of that, I dare say, is not going to be in a positive libertarian direction. Let's not forget that one of the things that tariffs do is that it makes Washington a thrumming hive of activity of people trying to get around those tariffs. It is a magnet for corruption. Trump is not allergic to corruption. To say the least, corruption, not a libertarian value. Lying all the time, not a libertarian value. Making fun jokes about your alliance partners about how you're going to forcibly, maybe, or just not rule out forcibly acquiring their territory. Super not libertarian. So I don't have
Matt, Greenland has always been America's.
Or actually
Donald Trump Jr.'s.
Psychically agree with you. But that's a different thing altogether. As we all know, pro independence for both Hawaii and Alaska, but that's a separate podcast at this point.
The first I'm hearing of this.
Can we give a shout out to the question asker?
If you don't listen, that's not my problem.
Yeah. Can I give a shout out to the question asker before we move on?
Yes.
He's great. I just want to say hi, Steve, because he, among other things, is a regular correspondent. He is one of the lead designers of the original Ms. Pac-Man, just in case you were wondering if we had cool people up in here. And
Lifetime
also,
he that game was so much harder.
Sent me a very lovely Christmas card. So, hi, Steve.
I want a non-binary Pac-Man.
Pac with the X.
That's that's that America changed in November, Nick.
Pack they.
Okay. All right. Why not? Let the end user configure into whatever gender, and also maybe have meat instead of fruit. You know, why are we having to play a vegetarian, even a vegan game, Matt?
Nick,
put a wheel of cheese out there for guys.
Like pornography, if you have thought about it, it has already happened.
Yeah.
All right, let's continue the Zucker chain discussion. I'm more about the hair than the chain, frankly.
Yeah, the hair is fantastic.
I respect it. Yeah.
No notes.
Last week, Meta Mark had started launching a bit of a media tour, releasing a video, doing the podcast circuit, making some noises about going down to Mar-a-Lago, announcing that he's going to be dismantling his fact-checking apparatus. He was complaining pretty sharp language about the Biden administration attempts to put pressure on Facebook and other social media companies to censor people in the wake of COVID and other kind of matters. He indicated eagerness to work with Trump on combating global censorship. He appointed Dana White, UFC's Dana White, Trump pal, to the board of Facebook and so forth. Catherine, there's been a lot of commentary on the journalistic left, and sorry for the repetition, about Zuckerberg bending the knee to Trump. And yet here I see in the pages of the digital pages of Reason.com, Robbie Suave and Liz Wolf getting all happy and excited. So since when does Reason love it when titans of commerce, capitalism, whatever the word is, bend the knee to presidents, damn it.
Yeah, I mean, I think the knee-bending evidence is there, for sure. And it shouldn't be overlooked, and it should make us nervous because, as I said, I think when it comes down to, like, hey, is the, you know, are some of these, like, libertarian-ish looking things, when they come into contact with just, like, Trump's authoritarian impulses, like, which one will win out? I just don't have a ton of faith that these folks who did not come in as ideologues will feel the need to maintain their ideological purity. That said, I feel like this is a thing. This is a known category. Mark Zuckerberg getting a tan and a necklace and a new T-shirt and some hair and doing the mixed martial arts or whatever he's doing. Like, I am aware of that type of person doing that type of thing.
You mean 40-year-old
men? 40-year-old
men who have been somewhat successful, but maybe are having some thoughts about their lives.
I'm just saying, I have some knowledge of these dudes, and
they're bending the knee, but only at the squat rack.
They're bending the knee at the squat rack. That actually is what I was. That is exactly right. Is like I think that from time immemorial, the vast majority of titans of industry have chosen their level of how much they are going to invest in, suck up to Washington. And at this point, D.C. is basically in Donald Trump's hands, right? There are not a lot of other avenues to get what you want in this city right now, because the Republican Party is in charge and Donald Trump is 100% in charge of the Republican Party. I don't think it's admirable. I have always loved the folks in industry who just say, like, we're not even going to have any lobbyists. Like, screw you guys. And you know what happens to those people?
They get crushed.
Bad things happen
Super
to those people. But I do like it. Anyway, all of this is just by way of saying, I do think there's some sincerity to this. Like, clearly Zucks is going through it. He's changing his, and he looked so sad and so miserable for all those years where he was just like in his little suit getting yelled at by Congress, so pale. And as he looks like he's happier now, and he seems like he's being a little more libertarian, and I'll take it.
Peter, can you put this in the context of Republicans taking over Washington? I mean, there's been oftentimes a Republican-led backlash against Silicon Valley and social media companies. There's a TikTok decision imminent at the Supreme Court. Mixed messages at this point, I think, from the incoming Trump administration, even compared to where he was 9 to 12 months ago. Where does this all fit in, and what should we be looking on the lookout for in terms of, you know, early signposts of where the Trump administration is going to go vis-a-vis tech, social media, free speech?
So I think Zuckerberg's announcement can be seen multiple ways. And one is as a kind of appeasement to a new Republican power center in Washington, D.C. Republicans have complained pretty heavily for the last decade that social media, in particular Facebook, is the new public square, and that it has been systematically suppressing conservative views and voices. That's not necessarily been true. In fact, if you looked at the top performing accounts on Facebook back in the days when they were allowing and even boosting news content, often it was conservative, conservative organizations like the Daily Wire and like some of the
pro-Trump
media. Yep, right. So like some of the pro-Trump, folks on the right. At the same time, this has been a complaint. And so you can, I think, it's not totally unreasonable to look at this as we're trying to curry favor or we're trying to appease these folks who have been mad at us for a long time. At the same time, I also think you can look at this as Zuck not just going through it, but going back to his roots, because that is, in fact, what men in their 40s who are like, what has my life come to? They're like, no, I'm going to go back to the thing I used to believe when I was 20, when I was young and when I was brash and before I'd really made it. And that's what made me successful to begin with, because what Zuckerberg has always said, even throughout the periods where he had a team of fact checkers, and even where there was algorithmic suppression or, shadow banning of accounts or whatever it is we're going to talk about here, what he has always said is that he did not want himself or his organization, Facebook, Meta, whatever it's called, he did not want to be the arbiter of truth. And that is a phrase that we have heard from Zuckerberg for years now. And I think that that reflects at least something like a genuine feeling on his part that he's always wanted Facebook not to be in the truth deciding business. And so the move he has made here is to take Facebook out of the fact-checking business and instead turn that over to the crowd. right, and crowdsource essentially fact checking, which is the way that that Community Notes works on X. It's imperfect. It allows the false information to travel for a while before the crowd actually responds. It doesn't work exactly the way you would ideally want if you sort of imagined a perfect system. On the other hand, it's not clear that there is a better system, and I think that a decentralized system that allows the crowd to make these determinations and allows for a kind of back and forth essentially between the crowdsourced fact checkers and the people posting, that is probably going to end up working better to promote the truth and to promote interesting debate and ideas than a centralized system of fact checkers based in Palo Alto.
Nick, welcome Vibe Shift or Worrying Corporatism.
You know what? I like this version of Zuck better than the one that was creeping around D.C. You know, in 2018 when he was sucking up to Congress, congressional committees that had a lot of Republicans as well as Democrats on them. And he was like, yeah, okay, it's time for regulation. I'm going to help you write the regulations because I'm the one who knows our business. We should be very nervous when plutocrats start openly, you know, entering into coalitions with the elected leaders of our country. I don't think Zuck is the worst. Facebook can't get worse, essentially. Instagram could, but I think this is good, and I hope this is where he sticks, at least for the rest of my life. But I'm worried by this. I'm worried by particularly the way Elon Musk is now, you know, somehow treating all governments as, you know, some division of X. I'm very worried about the $40 million Jeff Bezos documentary about Melania Trump. I love Amazon. Amazon has made my life. I cannot even calculate how much better Amazon has made my life. And it is mostly, you know, springing from the brow of Jeff Bezos, but it deeply worries me. When people start to do stuff like, okay, let's do a $40 million documentary or a project on Prime Video about Melania Trump, just in the way that, you know, when Netflix or whoever starts currying favor with politicos, we should recognize that, you know, the interests of markets and individual people always align. The interests of billionaires and individual people don't necessarily always track in the same true libertarian, decentralist, more autonomy, more freedom, more let me do what I want direction as we might want.
The other thing that's just worth noting is that this is also in keeping with how Zuckerberg has handled transitions in the White House before. This is the third time that there has been a transition in the White House, and Zuckerberg has come out shortly afterwards and said, we're changing our content moderation policies. So in some ways, this is just how he's always run Facebook, Meta, whatever we're going to call it.
Weird. All right, let's get to our end of podcast, what we have all been consuming in the cultural arena. Catherine, why don't you lead us off?
Yes, I love a good 22-minute sitcom-y type show, and I have a new one that I would like to recommend. It's called A Man on the Inside. If you liked The Good Place, and in particular, if you liked Ted Danson's enthusiastic yet befuddled elderly gentleman, you can have more of him in this show. It's the same guy, and the show is from Michael Schur, who's the also of The Good Place and Community and other shows. He's an old dude who needs something to do, and so he gets a job as a private investigator of a jewelry theft in a retirement home. And it's hilarious. He has little spy glasses, and he's extremely enthused about being a fake spy. I don't know that it has a lot of libertarian lessons, to be quite honest. Maybe the total disregard with which people treat the police for this story. Like, at no point does anyone say, like, perhaps the police should solve this crime. It's probably just a dramatic device. But it's fun. It's delightful. It's a meditation on the nature of age and mortality. But mostly it's a silly show about a detective, a man on the inside.
I've got a follow-up question that opened to the whole table, but Catherine, to begin with, which is, I haven't followed any of I've been blanking Ted on his
Danson?
Name. Dan Danson.
Ted Danson's worked since his...
Since Sam
his,
Malone. Has he been just playing...
I thought you were going to say with Whoopi Goldberg. He made a wonderful appearance at the Friars Club roast.
Did not watch that one. If he was in 3 Men and a Baby, I guess I saw that, but I don't remember. But like, has he just been playing Sam Malone the whole time? And please have the answer be yes.
Yes.
That makes me happy.
But like, he's not. He's not at all. He's almost never a womanizer in the way that Sam Malone was.
Well,
he's a bit of he's a bit of a ladies' man in this show, I would say. No, I mean, in The Good Place, he plays this character, but he's also secretly like a multidimensional demon. So that's cool.
Yeah. So a ladies' man.
We are not talking about Neil Gaiman here, okay?
He has a fantastic turn in Damages, a show that starred Glenn Close as a, you know, real ball cutter attorney that is fantastic. And Rose Byrne was in it too. And Ted Danson had a 1 or 2 season arc as a billionaire trying to reclaim his public image. He's phenomenal. He's had like the greatest third act in American, theater, I think.
His pocket square is like a major character in this show, if that gives you just a sense of what's going on here.
That sounds fantastic. Peter, what did you consume?
I watched The Brutalist. It is an incredible epic of American cinema. I was just totally blown away by this film. If you like Joe Rogan, I'm not necessarily going to say that there's a direct transference here, but one of the things about Joe Rogan is every episode is 3 hours long. Movie is 3.5 hours long, including a timed intermission that plays on screen so you can get up and go to the bathroom. But even in the intermission, they are delivering kind of interesting information because this is a movie about the Jewish immigrant experience in the post-war America. And it kind of reframes the entire mid-century of the American experience as fundamentally about like dealing with the Holocaust and what it left the world with. And so it's about an architect who is a Hungarian Jew, played by Adrian Brody, who arrives in the United States. And it's just this fantastic kind of opening bit. You see the boat and there's chaos and not really sure what's going on. It comes out into the open air and it's the sky. And the camera is so shaky and strange that you see the Statue of Liberty and it's upside down. And that's kind of the movie, right? Is like, now what are you going to do? And so he makes his way through the world and ends up finding himself as the architect for this kind of mega project in the middle of nowhere, Pennsylvania, in Doylestown. He's supposed to be making a community center. And like at the very end, after he's already basically agreed to it, they're like, but one other thing. It's got to have a place of Christian worship and a whole bunch of Christian symbols, right? And it's this, you know, sort of the movie is about the ways in which America kind of demanded of Jewish immigrants that they conform and that they not sort of hold true to their own values. And then what you find out slowly over the course of this is that he has been makes this space in the image of his own trauma and his own world and his own experiences. And it is about how immigrants, sometimes who have been pressed to do things that are arguably objectionable or in the case of this movie, quite horrific, and still ended up making the art and making the world into their own image and into their own vision for what the world should be, processed through the trauma of the Holocaust. Just an absolutely fascinating, beautiful, intense, great American film by a very young director. This guy is still in his 30s. And so Brady Corbett, this is one of his very first movies. And so I am very curious to see what it is that he ends up doing next.
If I may, because I saw that before Christmas, actually, I was in L.A. and Fountainhead fans will find it interesting because it's very much a tale of an architect who refuses to ultimately to submit his designs to any kind of artistic or ideological compromise. I found it to be kind of the 21st century definition of self-indulgent, lazy art filmmaking, to be quite honest. I love Adrian Brody, and I just it was easily an hour too long for my taste. But I think if you love The Fountainhead, you're going to love this.
On the basic topic, perhaps worth adding that Pacific Palisades, one of the aspects of the little village, is that it's a classic place for Jewish immigrant 20th century experience in Southern California.
And it was preserved correctly, right?
Some of it by the
person who might have been mayor rather than Karen Bass.
Yes, Rick Caruso. Who are we on now? Nick Gillespie? Yes, you're next.
I watched Joy, the Birth of IVF, which is a new Netflix show. And, you know, a couple of months ago, Netflix said that they were going to actually start making good stuff again. And I have to say the early results are like I find myself watching more Netflix than I had in the previous year. But it is it's about the creators of IVF, Robert Edwards, a British physician or medical researcher, ultimately won a Nobel Prize for it, Patrick Steptoe, and Jean Purdy. It is a great documentary about one of the most important and promising and great things to happen, you know, say, since reason, you know, came into existence, because the early research and whatnot started around 1968. In England, Louise Brown was born in 1978. Since then, 12 million people is the general estimate of people who have been born via IVF. It remains a real flashpoint. Is it Promethean? Is it demonic? Is it, you know, what God wants us to create? Last year, Republican senators voted down a legislation that would have secured a right to IVF at the national level. Donald Trump on the campaign trail said that IVF should be covered by all insurance policies. It is a fantastic story.
Because he's a great libertarian, right?
What's that?
That's because he's a great libertarian.
He's the most libertarian. You know, he spends other people's dollars, right? It's a really good, tight documentary about something that most of us have come to take for granted. But this is a dividing line. I know a lot of people who are anti-abortion and are also anti-IVF. And, you know, it's not going away, but it's a great look at it. The one criticism I would have for it is that the movie didn't go into the level of vitriol and hatred spewed towards the inventors of this process. And as it came online, and if you go back and look, when people were freaking out over test tube babies and things like that, this was supposed to be the end of civilization. And in the end, it was merely the beginning of, you know, 12 million people who wouldn't exist otherwise. So worth looking at.
So the book that I'm going to recommend, it is true that it seems like it was designed in a laboratory for me to enjoy it. Christmas present. It's called My American Revolution. The hardcover has as the
by Bobby Gritch
as that was the missing ingredient. The hardcover subtitle is Crossing the Delaware in I-78. The paperback subtitle is A Modern Expedition Through History's Forgotten Battlegrounds. It was written by Robert Sullivan about 12 years ago, who at the time was a 50-something brownstone Brooklyn neighborhood history dad. Who really enjoyed walking around and noticing that there were pretty interesting and largely forgotten signposts of the American Revolution all around us, and then thus seeks out to kind of explore them in like Morristown, New Jersey, which is not far away, which is Washington's winter camp for a couple of winters, in various places very close to where I'm podcasting to you, with the Battle of Brooklyn and the Dunkirk-style evacuation of Brooklyn Heights and plenty of other things besides. And it's just basically him turtling around and annoying his family, but they're kind of indulgent of him doing crazy stuff like trying to be on a hilltop in New Jersey and flashing a mirrored light to his daughter at St. Anne's in Brooklyn Heights to see whether she could see it from 30 miles away or something. That's kind of how the book closes. But just, I read it in a day. Great fun. Kind of a prompt to go out and notice the history that you live among and the layers of it. And it's also kind of in a low-key way a meditation on why some things are remembered and why they are not. Why do we think about Valley Forge and we don't think about Morristown? Why do we think about crossing the Delaware and not the East River, which without which the Revolutionary War would have been over in August of 1776? And there are a variety of good and random reasons for that. But it's mostly just a really rollicking, fun read, gobbled it up straight down. Robert Sullivan, My American Revolution, regardless of subtitle, go check it out. All right. Thank you for listening. And we will, next time we come to you, there's going to be a new president, a new old president. So that's very exciting to happen between now and then. I think we're going to come to you on the Tuesday after inauguration. And so I want to say to Nick Gillespie, what events do we have that people can look forward to that they might be able to participate in, if any?
Oh, on January 21st, that same Tuesday that you just mentioned, Matt Welch, in New York, we'll be doing a recent speakeasy about immigration. And we'll be having Brian Kaplan and David Beer of Cato talking about the libertarian case for more immigration. Go to reason.com/events, and you can still get tickets, and it will run also as a Reason interview video and podcast.
Can I do another little advertisement?
Yeah, please.
Since maybe TikTok isn't going to exist in a week, you should check us out on all the various social medias. We have a whole bunch of great little fun videos there on Instagram. They're on YouTube Shorts, but they are also on TikTok. If you've been scared to download TikTok because you are maybe going to get addicted, do it this week. Maybe it won't exist next week. And maybe after that, all of the young people will become libertarian because the government took their TikTok away. Just a little hope for the future.
Does our TikTok channel have a lot of skibbity toilet riz?
No skibbity toilets on there, but a lot of super fun videos, including Reason's own Emma Camp testing positive for morphine. So check it out.
There we go. Go to all our podcasts at reason.com/podcasts. And if you feel like helping us do our work here, go to reason.com/donate and make a tax-free donation. Okay, thank you. See you next week. Goodbye.